Welcome to Discovery 1, Module 5, Revision. Just in case you thought it was Module 5 all over again. Now, before I get started, did anybody from last Friday, and I don't think we've got too many on this morning, but did anybody from last Friday find the notes on www.qcat.org? Am I going to be a happy person? In fact, is anybody here not using the notes still on www.qcat.org? We've certainly got the pair in the corner on fire this morning. Smell the smoke from them from here. Okay. Now, this morning we are revisiting Module 5. And Module 5 is the one with all of the nasty IP address stuff in it that everybody doesn't really like, and nobody likes adding things up because maths is evil. Okay. Let me wise you up now. If you don't get good at adding these things up, by the end of CCNA Discovery 1, I'd be seriously thinking about whether you should be going on to Discovery 2, because there is at least this subnetting you do have to be able to do just about in your sleep. And for anybody who has wondered, yes, I have done subnetting in my sleep, literally. So it's a good thing to get good at, and I'll be setting some more exercises for those who think they need the practice. If you don't think you need the practice, you don't need to do the exercises. But you guys you guys are old enough to make that decision for yourselves, so you get to decide one way or the other. You are allowed to use a calculator to add up the binary powers of 2, so that will make your life a bit easier. We don't encourage the use of calculator to do the actual binary to decimal conversions because you are not permitted to use the scientific mode of a calculator inside the Pearson VUE testing centres. I'm just turning on my AutoVox and I'll be back with you all in a moment. Does anybody have any questions before I get started revisiting Module 5? Any questions on any part of the Discovery curriculum? And I'd like people to think about anything else they'd like revised in the next 4 or 5 weeks before you all sit the final. And if anybody says the whole course, I'm going to point you to www.qcat.org/class_notes/discovery/discovery1/audio. But if we can be a bit more specific about what we'd like revisited, that can certainly happen over the next few weeks. Okay, so do we have any questions on anything that's pending and outstanding? I know that not everybody is up to the same point, and I know that some people are at different rates of progress through the course, and that's fine. I don't expect everybody to know about Module 9 if you've only made your way up to Module 4. So does anybody have any questions before I get started on Chapter 5?
Any word on our diagram description?
No, as usual, no. And the person who would be able to tell me what was going on with that isn't here today, and I don't know why. And there's nothing on his Twitter. Okay, now there are diagram descriptions for the chapters, but no, there are not diagram descriptions for the exam. Yes, I know it's a problem. No, I can't do much about it. However, after Friday, Jammer and I will probably be able to sit down and do the diagram descriptions if nobody else does. If anybody knows of anybody who will volunteer to sit down and voluntarily do some diagram descriptions for the exam, you just drop CAVI instructors an email and we will get them to do as many as they want for the exams. We actually find that it's one of the hardest jobs to get people to do because it's boring but very necessary. Okay, first question of the morning. Chat window's open for everybody who doesn't have their chat window open. How many bits in an IP address? We'd like more than one answer. Yep, that's right. I'm looking for an answer from everybody here. In fact, I'm even checking the names off to see who's going to answer and who's not. Yep, and we'll let the dream team in the corner off with one answer. So, yep, you've both answered that one. That's good. Okay, 32 bits in an IP address. How many bits in a MAC address? Excellent. Okay, now I'm not going to be this horrible for the whole lecture, but guys, I'm asking you the questions because it's meant to help you. I would just prefer not to ask you any questions at all and just deliver the material, but I just get the feeling that everybody's not going to get as much out of the lecture if I don't actually quiz you and ask you questions. I could just, you know, whip through all the prepared material and just, you know, read it all out and this is module 10 and we're doing revision of whatever. So, yeah, we'd like to do some quiz questions and make sure that people answer those questions to the best of their ability. And if you get them wrong, that's okay. It's not a big crime. Is our sign-up, guys? Just because it's something I always forget to do. Cool. We've got a sign-up here that says Lecture in Progress. Okay. And my notes are over here. Okie dokie. Each host needs an IP address. Well, actually, each interface on a host needs an IP address. And an IP address is 32 bits long. Can anybody tell me what is the name of the notation that we write IP addresses in, generally speaking? We don't usually specify them as a, let me get this right, 4-byte hex number. No, 8-byte hex number. Notation. Yes, we have two answers, dotted decimal and dotted decimal. I'd be happy with that. It is also called dotted decimal or dotted quad. You can also refer to an IP address as a dotted quad, which is four octets separated by full stops. Everybody happy with that? We've all seen 1.2.3.4 more times than we can point a web browser at a router. Okay, one address per interface. Every packet has a source and a destination address. Okay, the source is where the packet comes from, the destination is where the packet is going to. Interestingly enough, the destination address is stored first in the packet before the source address. Anybody know why? And no, it's not in your notes.
No idea.
Well, the reason it stores the destination address first is so that if you have a device that's reading the network frame, it can see the destination address first, prepare the routing table and switching logic before the rest of the packet turns up, which is important for cut-through switching. Alrighty. IP addresses in dotted decimal notation did that. Okay, the IP address is split into two parts. Can anybody tell me what one of those two parts are?
Host part?
Yeah, we have network and we have host.
Answers.
Yeah, everybody happy about that? Okay, good. Because if you're not, I'm just going to have to suggest that you have a cup of your favourite beverage and smile, because that's how it is. It's network and host. The network portion tells you what network the device is on, and the host portion tells you which host on which on the network that we are talking about. Can anybody tell me the name of the thing that tells you which bit of the IP address is the host and which bit is the network? What is the thing that determines how that split occurs? Any answers from anybody else? Yeah, fair enough. That's why we're revising Chapter 5. Okay, so that when we're finished, you will be. Subnet mask. So the subnet mask is what tells you how many bits are in the network portion and how many bits are in the host portion of the IP address. Now, as we have said, IP addresses are 32 bits long. And as far as computers are concerned, they are expressed natively in what form? Not the way we write them, but how do computers look at them? Okay, now I realise some of you are probably sitting here going, gee, he's being really simple this morning, but believe me, sometimes when you go back over one of these points and you say it for time number 3 or 4, the penny will drop for someone, or whatever your local currency is, and you will suddenly go, oh, I get it now. And that's what IP addresses is like. You spend 3 or 4 weeks absolutely belting your head against a brick wall, and then all of a sudden, it just suddenly becomes clear to you, and you wonder to yourself how you'd ever been so stupid. Then you get somebody else who doesn't understand IP addresses at all, and you realize that you really weren't stupid, and that possibly it is a hard concept, and you will get it eventually. So it's all good. Okay. And for Srigginth, has he turned up in here? Yes, he has. We're revising Module 5. Okay. So if you want the first bit, download the recording. All right. Back to my notes. Okay, routers need to locate networks, not necessarily the host on them. And we'll talk about routers in a minute. Does anybody want me to go back over the decimal to binary conversion process? Because I'm thinking that might be something we're a bit foggy on. Okie dokie, no problem. We can cert. Yep. Okay. Now, has anybody managed to get themselves a pegboard? Because you are really doing yourself a disservice if you haven't got one. If you can't buy them, you have to make them, and we can't ship them to you because they're a bit expensive. But basically, they are a bit of board, about 6 inches high and about maybe 15 inches wide. It has three lines of 32 holes drilled in it, and the lines are one above the other, and there is a slot every 8 holes, and you get bits of dowel that will fit into those holes, and that way you can put ones in where ones go and zeros in where zeros go. And there are diagrams on how to make a pegboard on www.qcat.org in student resources, general instructions, and there are actually pictures of the different pieces, and it would probably take somebody with a drill probably about 20 to 30 minutes if they were having a bad day to make one up, and a trip to Bunnings for the bit of radiata pine or whatever bit of wood you want to use. So optional, but highly recommended, and it will serve you well in your binary stuff if you are going into a career in networking. In fact, even network veterans find a pegboard an easy way to check off subnet masking. So that's my advertisement for the pegboard for today. And that's actually a Cavi innovation. We came up with that one. Ian came up with it, in fact. And now even the cited Cisco classes, there are actually people building pegboards and showing binary with pegboards for cited people. So there you go. Aren't we clever? All right. That's a rhetorical question, by the way. Now, binary is base 2. BI being bi, as in bicycle, biped, bilateral, bifocal, but not bye-bye, because we've still got lots of lecture left to go. You have two binary digits. Can anybody tell me what the two binary digits are? I'm sure this is... All right. Now, what is, and for those who weren't reading the chat, the answers were 0 and 1, because I've got to remember to say the things that come up on chat back into the lecture or you never hear them. Okay. When we used to record with the Mac, we actually used to have the synthesized speech on the recording, and that was kind of cool. And it kind of wasn't, so my sensitivity is a bit low here. Okay, 0 and 1. Now, does anybody... I'm going to go through very quickly the base 10 number system, because I think that's an important revision, just so that people know. And base 10 is the number system we normally use, okay? Now... So we have 10 discrete digits, 0 through 9. Everybody happy with that? 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah, good. Okay. Now, everything in the base 10 number system can be expressed as 10 to the power of something. And basically, we talked about the fact that anything to the power 0 is 1. Everybody remember that? So... 16 squillion to the power of 0 is 1, 10 to the power of 0 is 1, 2 to the power of 0 is 1, okay? So we can now say that any number between 0 and 9 is that number times 10 to the power of 0. So, for example, the number 6 is 6 times 10 to the power of 0. Everyone kind of happy with that? Or shall I slow down and give you all a little bit of time to think? Okay, we've got one yes. Do you want me to go back over that again in case... this is important because it's a keystone. So anybody who doesn't get it, speak up now and I'll go back over it again because we really do have to get this down. Otherwise, when I go into 2 to the power of us, you're just going to go out and get very drunk. Okay, now, anything raised to the power of 0 equals 1. And I can actually prove that, and the mathematical proof is not too bad. If we, when you are dividing powers, you have indices, and you subtract the indices when you are dividing powers. So, for example, 2 to the power of 3 divided by 2 to the power of 3. Now, 2 to the power of 3 is 8, so 8 divided by 8 is 1. Okay, so if we're subtracting the indices, which when we're doing division of powers, we say 3 minus 3 is 0, therefore 2 to the power of 0 is equal to 1. And I would completely understand if you need to go back through the recording after I've said that and actually dig out the mathematical proof, but that is why anything to the power of 0 is 1. So anything to the power of 0 is 1, except for 0 to the power of 0, which of course is 0. So anything except for 0. Okay. So, 2 to the power of 1... 2 to the power of 0, sorry. 0. 10 to the power of 0. 0. 16 to the power of... 10 to the power of 0. 1, 2, 3. Start again. I'm going to edit this bit out. 2 to the power of 0 is 1. 10 to the power of 0 is 1. 16 to the power of 0 is 1. 604 to the power of 0 is 1. Okay. Lucky I have a good copy of SoundForge and I can knock out those bits. So, 10 to the power of 0 is 1. The number 5 can be expressed as 5 times 1, or 5 times 10 to the power of 0. Okay, so, and if you still have trouble with that, and I'm not going to single you out, you can Skype me on my work account later, and I will sit down and go through it more slowly with whoever has trouble, or you can email me, and we can go through it, or whatever contact method suits you. Or you can MSN me if you happen to have my MSN. Okay, so 10 to the power of 0 is 1, 2 to the power of 0 is 1. The number 6 can be expressed as 6 times 10 to the power of 0. It can also be expressed as 6 times 2 to the power of 0, interestingly enough, but that's neither here nor there. Okay, now, the number 10, all right, the amazing number 10, which was how young I was 23 years ago. Okay, it is 1 lot of 10 plus 0 lots of 1. Okay, the number 11 is 1 lot of 10 plus 1 lot of 1. The number 65 is 6 lots of 10 plus 5 lots of 1. Anybody remember those Cuisinaire rods that we all used to use? I think they were Cuisinaire. Yeah, they were called Cuisinaire rods.
Yeah, they were
wooden. And you had like the 1s and you had the 10s and you had all the different ones. And you could have like a 10 rod and 10 1 rods.
And they were all like a 1 centimetre. One rod was 1 centimetre. Yeah. And a 10 was 10 centimetres long.
We've actually still got a complete set of them. I think Mum's still got a complete set of them. I'll have to see if she's still got them, because they're kind of handy. Okay. So, the number 65, and perhaps I should type this into chat just so that people can see it, because that might be easier for some people. Okay, so the number 65, 6 star 10, 5 star 1. Okay, everybody cool with that? Sorry, 6 star 10 plus 5 star 1. Okay, or 6 star 10 to the power of 1 plus 5 star 10 to the power 0. Okay. And I might actually email that out to the announce list later as well, because obviously chat is a bit volatile. So, 65 can be expressed as 6 times 10 to the power of 1. So 10 to the power of 1 is 10. So 6 times 10 is 60, plus 5 lots of 1, which is 10 to the power 0. Everybody does know how to raise a number to a particular power. You multiply the number by itself that many times. So 10 to the power of 2 is 10 times 10. 10 to the power of 7 is 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10. I think I got 7 in there. 10 to the power of 7 happens to be 10 million, just out of... 1 million. 10 million. I was right. Yeah, 10 to the power of 7 is 10 million. Yeah. Okay. Now, with base 10, we have special names for the numbers, okay? So 10 to the power of 0, they're 1s. 10 to the power of 1s, they're called 10s. And we have names for those, 10, 20, 30, 40, all the way up to 90, okay? 10 to the power of 2 is 100. 100, 200, 300. So 347 is 3 lots of 10 to the power of 2, plus 4 lots of 10 to the power of 1, plus 7 lots of 10 to the power of 0. But we have funky names for it, so it's 347, or 347. Is this making sense to anybody, or have I just managed to confuse you all very badly?
No, I think I've got it.
Okie dokie. Well, we'll find out soon, because don't worry, we're going to turn your brains inside out. So 10 to the power of... Can anybody tell me what 10 to the power of 3 is called? What's 10 to the power of 3?
100?
No. Yes, 1,000. What is 10 to the power of 6? Now, an easy way to do 10 to the power of 3 is a 1 and 3 zeros, because it's to the power of 3. 10 to the power of 4 is 1 and 4 zeros. A million is 10 to the power of 6, 1 and 6 zeros. So, what's 10 to the power of 9?
1 and 9 zeros. Or billions.
100 million.
Yeah, which if you are American or scientific, will give you a billion. No, 10 to the power of 9 is a billion. That's all right. That's okay. Now, this raises an interesting question. I'm just going to ask this to be really nasty. Can anybody tell me what 10 to the minus 1 is? And you can use Windows calculator if you don't know. That is exactly right. Well done, Srigiv. And excuse my pronunciation, because that's what eloquence says. Okay, so what's 10 to the power of minus 2?
0.01?
That is correct. Well done, Grace. Okay. Now, what they used to do in the old days, before we had calculators, was you had what we call log tables. And what you would do is you would take the natural log of two numbers, and if you wanted to multiply two numbers together, say for example you were multiplying 604 by 10,205, which I don't need you to do, it's just an example, you would take the natural log of 605 and you'd take the natural log of 10,204, and you would add them up, and you would then look up the anti-log table to find out what the anti-log of that was, and that would give you the answer to your question. And that's what we used to use logarithms for.
Glad we have calculators.
Well, actually, once you got used to using log tables and a slide rule, it wasn't so bad. That's how they work. That was you actually had a book of log tables that you would use for your mathematics and stuff. So it is nice that you have calculators, although some of the binary calculators can actually make mistakes, especially if they're cheap ones. And you can actually test this by if you go 445 times 45 divided by 45, if you have a good calculator, it'll say 445. But if you have a slightly dodgy one, it'll say 444.9999999999, which isn't so cool. So it's very important that when you are using a calculator, that you have an approximate idea of what the answer should be, so that if the calculator throws up a stupid answer, you will actually have some idea that you've botched it up. Because a lot of the errors happen because people put the wrong things into calculators and don't realize it. Okie dokie. We'll get back to binary. Now, so we said that anything to the power 0 was 1. So, and binary works in base 2. Okay? Interestingly enough, none of this math theory is actually in the course itself, because they expect you to have done year 10 high school. But my experience has been that not everybody remembers mathematics for as long as the high school would like you to. In fact, I saw somebody add up 9 and 6 on the calculator the other day. That was not very cool. They 9 plus 6. Yeah, I'm just like, it's 15. And they're like, wow, you worked that out? I'm like, yeah, I must have had one neuron firing today. Okie dokies. Binary is base 2. And you have two possible digits. You have 0 and you have 1. Okay? So what we need is our powers of 2. Because 2 to the power 0 is... Anybody tell me? 2 to the power 0. Yes. Okay, anybody tell me what... so I'll just type this for reference. 2 caret 0 equals 1. And, of course, eSpeak doesn't speak the punctuation, so that's a bit of a pain. I've got to figure out how to fix that. Now, 2 caret 1. Anybody tell me what 2 caret 1 is? 2 to the power of 1. It is 2 to the power of 1. 2 to the power of 1 is 2. Yep. Okay, what's 2 to the power of 2? It is. Now, does anybody remember that song about the inchworm? It's a bit old. Yeah, you know, inchworm, remembering our arithmetic. 1 and 1 is 2, 2 and 2 is 4, 4 and 4 is 8, 8 and 8 is 16, 16 and 16 is 32. Inchworm. Anyway, that's enough of that, okay? But they're your powers of 2. So if you know the inchworm song, you can get all the way up to 32. 1 and 1 is 2. 2 and 2 is 4. 4 and 4 is 8. 8 and 8 is 16. 16 and 16 is 32. 32 and 32 is 64. 64 and 64 is 128. 128 is 256. Yeah, something like that. Well, at least I didn't go 2 and 2 is 4. That would be even worse. Okay. We're not going to sing in every lecture, if you're Geraldine, you probably do sing in every lecture, but that's okay. Now, it's very important that you write down somewhere these powers of 2, because you're going to need them. Okay? So if you're a cut-and-paste nasty, we have 1... 2. Oh, hang on. Oops. Okay, so we have 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256. And we are basically doubling the number. So we're not going to sing the inchworm song again. It was very tempting, but we won't. 2 to the power of 0, 2 to the power of 1, 2 to the power of 2, 2 to the power of 3, 2 to the power of 4, 2 to the power of 4 is 16, 2 to the power of 5 is 32, 2 to the power of 6 is 64, 2 to the power of 7 is 128, 2 to the power of 8 is 256. How do I know this? Because I've done far too much binary for my own good. And by the time you finish all the exercises I might have to set for you, if you guys still don't get it, you'll know binary as well as I will. It probably won't make your day-to-day life much better, but it will make your subnetting significantly easier. Okie dokie. Now, this is to say that any whole number can be expressed as a series of powers of 2 added together. So let's take the number 7, for example. Okay? we find the biggest power of 2 that we can subtract from 7. Can anybody tell me what that number would be in the powers of 2? And we're doing with 1, 2, 4, and 8 are probably the numbers that we're interested in. Okie dokie. So we've said that the number 4, which is 2 to the power of 2, is the one we can subtract from 7. So we say 7 minus 4, what are we left with?
3.
Yeah, okay. So what's the biggest power of 2 you can subtract from 3? Yes, that is correct. The biggest power of 2 is 2 to the power of 1. So we have 3 minus 2 is 1. And what's the biggest power of 2 we can extract from? Yes, so the binary for that turns into 1, 1, 1. 1 lot of 2 to the power of 0, 1 lot of 2 to the power of 1, and 1 lot of 2 to the power of 2, or 1 plus 2 plus 4 equals 7. And for the remote students, I'm tapping on the desk as I say that. The local students would know that, but you won't hear that through my microphone. Okay, any questions on that so far? I'm going to do a bigger number in a minute. Alright, so that's how we convert a number from decimal into binary. We find the biggest power of 2 that we can subtract from the number. We then write a 1 down. We then find the next biggest power of 2. Now, if the next biggest power of 2 is more than 1 below the power of 2 we just found, we have to write the zeros in between them. So if we say that we can subtract 2 to the power of 8 from our number, we put a 1. And then if the next number we can subtract is 2 to the power of 5, we have to put a 0 for the 2 to the power of 7, a 0 for the 2 to the power of 6, and then we put a 1 for the 2 to the power of 5 that we can subtract. So for every power of 2 we can subtract, we put a 1, and we work from the left to the right, obviously. And for every power of 2 that we can't subtract, we have to put a 0. There are other methods of doing binary. For example, and this is another method that one of our students uses, you divide the number by 2, and then if you get a 0, you write a 0, and if you get a 1, you write a 1, and then once you've finished writing all the remainders, you then reverse what you've got and turn it around the other way, and that gives you the binary. Not my favourite method, but it works for Alex. Whatever method you would like to use to do the binary conversion is up to you. I don't really care, as long as you understand it and you get the answers. Okay, so we find the biggest power of 2 that we can subtract from the number, and we write down a 1. We then find the next biggest power of 2 we can subtract, and if that power of 2 is more than 1 less than the one we had previously, we put the intervening zeros between it. So if we have 2 to the power of 8, and then we can subtract 2 to the power of 5, we have to put a 0 for the 2 to the power of 7 spot, a 0 for the 2 to the power of 6 spot, and a 1 for the 2 to the power of 5 spot. Any questions? I realise that people are going to need practice with that, but any sort of questions on that so far? Basically what we are doing is we are finding the one unique combination of powers of 2 that will add together to give us any particular number. So let's say, for example, we have the number 75. Okay, we want to find the unique set of powers of 2 that will make up 75. Okay, what is the biggest number that we can subtract from 75 that is a power of 2? 64. Right, we can tell Grace has had a nap this afternoon. She's faster than a I don't know, stock market ticker.
Speedy
okay, bullet. 64. I always wondered about a speeding bullet. I mean, were there actually bullets that do stick to the speed limit? Are they the ones that don't get caught by the radar?
Oh, definitely.
That reminds me of that thing, Mooper-san, poor mouthful than a beating spullet, faster than a mocha-lotive, able to beep tall lildings in a bengal sound, vain stricter from Penotheranet, who cunningly disguises Kirk Clint, fights for Juth, trust us, and the American, eh? Okay, that was just a bit silly. Now, 64. So 75 minus 64. Anybody tell me what that is? Okay. All right. Now, obviously, there's a couple of students that are absolutely lightning on the mathematics. So, we have put a 1 down for our power of, for our 64. Yeah, we don't want the answer yet. Okay, yeah, all right. Now, we then put a 0 down for the 32. We put a 0 down for the 16. Okay, so 100. We then put, so I've got 11 left. We can then subtract, what can we subtract from 11? What's the biggest power of 2 we can extract from 11? Yes, that's right. So we put a 1 in the 8 position. And we can then, we can't subtract 4 because we've only got 3 left. Yep, so we can have 3. So we put a 0, and then we put a 1 and a 1. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, let's hope it's not terminal. Alright, now, to convert back the other way, if we want to convert from binary back to decimal, what we do is we look at which bits of the byte are set to 1. Okay, so let's take an example here. So if we have the number... Okay, we have 8 lots of 1 written there. 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. That reminds me of 1, 1 was a racer. We're not going to sing that either. We add all of the powers of 2 together. Okay, so we usually work from the right. So we say 2 to the power of 0 plus 2 to the power of 1 plus 2 to the power of 2 plus 2 to the power of 3. Okay, so what we end up with is 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8 plus 16, 32, plus 64, 128. And that is correct. That's exactly right. And we end up with 255. Okay? That's eight bits set to 1. Which therefore tells us that a byte has a range of 0 to 255. Okay, 1 byte, being 8 bits, is, or 1 octet, is from 0 to 255. In other words, 256 combinations, because 0 is a valid combination, but 0 to 255. Everyone cool with that? Or at least relatively cool with that? Okie dokie. Okay, try and stay awake up the other end, guys. We'd have to inject coffee intravenously. Now, the IP addresses and subnet masks, okay? Here we go. And this may make a little more sense now. First of all, I have to discuss a couple of logical operations. Now, logical operations are part of what we call Boolean arithmetic. I think it's B-U-L-E-A-N. I'm not 100% sure how you spell that, but you can look it up on Wikipedia. It's there. Now, if we consider that we have two combinations of binary, the switch can either be on or the switch can be off. Okay? So if we visualize a circuit with a battery, a switch, and a light bulb, all wired in series, for you electronics people, when the switch is on or closed, the light will go on. When the switch is open or off, the light bulb will be off. Everybody cool with that?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, you have a question there, do you, Elise?
No, I'm just saying I'm cool with that.
Ah, you sort of went, and I'm just sort of like, well, was there a query? So that was like,
no,
that's
no, I
cool.
Went, mm-hmm. You must have missed the wrong bit of the mm-hmm.
Ah, yes, I did. I got the but not the hmm. Okay. Okay, so when you turn the switch on, the light goes on. When you turn the switch off, the light goes off. I once saw a funny quote that says, "You bet light travels fast. Try opening the fridge door before the light comes on." Okay. That, of course, doesn't work for a completely different reason. If you have, there are various ways of wiring up things so that they do different things. Now, most computer circuits and most logic circuits and most TTL logic relies on the input of something being a 0 or a 1, or the current to be flowing or not flowing depending on the circuit. Okay? Now, if we have a battery, a light bulb, and a switch on either side of the circuit. So we have battery, switch, light bulb, switch, back to the battery. In which position do the switches have to be for the light to be on? And we've got two switches all wired in series.
They have to be on. Or closed.
Yeah, they have to be on. I steer clear of up and down because I've seen light switches wired upside down.
Americans are different from
us too. Yeah, they are. They're up. Yeah, they're up for on. That's because we're upside down, I think.
No, they are.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. No, up is on.
No.
Here we go. We're
the rest of the world.
And in the green corner, it's Scott and Elise. In the red corner, it's Grace. Round one. Okay, now. Right. So if maybe the two switches are... Maybe not. Maybe we'll all get on well and cooperate and help each other with our binary. So, if the two switches are on, the light goes on. If one of the switches is off, the light is off. Okay, this is called an AND gate, because both of the inputs must be 1 for the output to be 1. So I'm going to write out a truth table into chat, and I'm going to be multi-talented, and I'm going to say it at the same time. 0 and 0 is 0. Okay, so both switches off, the light bulb is off. 0 and 1 is 0. One of the switches is on, the light bulb is still off. 1 and 0 is 0. Okay, I think I just double typed that. 0 and 1 is 0. Yep, there we go. 1 and 1 is 1. Okay, so if both switches are on, the light bulb is on. Any other combination, the light bulb is off. How are we going with that? Yeah?
Yeah.
She's cool.
Now, the other thing I'm interested in, and if anybody has any feedback on my... if anybody has any of my... any comments on my delivery style or suggestions they would like to make on how this is delivered or expressed, you can email caviinstructors@gots.net, because we are always keen to, perfect the teaching methods, because it is a difficult concept to do. Okay, and what I just typed up is what we call a truth table. It's for people who don't really understand the logical operations yet, and it shows you all of the possible combinations and their possible outputs. So 0 and 0 is 0, 0 and 1 is 0, 1 and 0 is 0, 1 and 1 is 1. Okay, let's say, for example, now we have a battery, and we have two circuits wired in parallel to the battery, so you've got two circuits, but they both go to the same light bulb. They're both sort of wired, sort of one circuit on one side and one circuit on the other, but each circuit has a switch on it. Can anybody tell me what sort of gate this is called?
Would this be an OR gate?
Yes, it is. It's an OR gate, and I'll explain why. So we have two separate circuits running to the same light bulb. Each circuit has a switch on it. If any of those circuits is on, one or the other, or both, the light bulb is on. Okay, so here we go. 0 or 0 is 0. If both switches are off, the light bulb is off. 0 or 1 is 1. If one of the switches is on, the light bulb is on. 1 or 0 is 0. If the other switch is on, the light bulb is on. 1 or 1 is 1. If both switches are on, the light bulb is on.
I get it.
Okay, I thought that it was, if both switches were on, it was off. For some reason, but...
No. Yeah. The reason you're wrong, and I'll explain this, is what actually happens is if you have both circuits closed, and what you're actually talking about is an exclusive OR gate, which I'm getting to in a minute. Okay, so there is a gate that does what you say it does, but it's not an OR gate. An OR gate means that if you have both of the switches on and you have both circuits closed, then a percentage of the current will flow over both circuits and it will reach the light bulb. So the light bulb will be on.
Got a question.
Yes.
Would it be roughly 50% in each circuit?
Yes and no, because when you actually have... If the wires were the same length and exactly the same consistency, it would be 50%. But there is actually a formula for calculating resistance values in parallel. Okay, so if you've got resistances in series, you add the resistances together. So if you've got a resistance of 10 ohms and 40 ohms, you add the two resistances together and you get 50 ohms. But if you've got resistors in parallel, there is actually a different formula because the current will tend to take the easiest path.
Yeah, no, that's understandable and a little bit outside the scope of this.
Yes, but since when have my lectures been inside the scope all the time? So we deal with this because people are curious. Okie dokie, now we're talking about the gate that Grace has brought up called the exclusive OR gate. I typed out the truth table for the OR gate, didn't I? Yeah, I did. Yeah, I remember
doing
that.
You did 1 OR 1 is 1, OR 1 OR 0 is 1, and 0 OR 1 is 1.
And 0 OR 0 is 0.
Yes, that was the first one I did. Sorry, I missed it.
1 OR 0 is 1. Because you've got two circuits, if either of the circuits is closed, electricity will travel through it and the light bulb will light up. Because you've got two separate circuits, each circuit with a switch on it, if any circuit is closed, then electricity will flow to the light bulb on the OR gate. Electricity doesn't care which circuit it travels through, it will travel through any circuit that is closed. So 1 OR 0 is 0 means that if 1 OR 0 is 1, you've confused me now. 1 OR 0 is 1 because the first circuit is closed. 0 OR 1 is 1 because the second circuit is closed. The power doesn't care which circuit it travels through as long as there is a closed loop for it to travel through. The light bulb will go on in an OR gate. Imagine you had two garden hoses attached to taps. And you had the two garden hoses. I don't know why you do this, right? But you are, because it's an example. And you've got two garden hoses, and you've got them both hooked into the same sprinkler system. If you turn either of the taps on, then you'll get water coming out the sprinkler. If you turn both of the taps on, you'll get half of the pressure from each tap actually feeding into the sprinkler system. Does that make it a bit more real world?
Yeah. For all those countries out there who are still allowed to use sprinklers.
Oh, we are. You're just not supposed to use them very often.
Okay. You've got less water restrictions over there, have you?
No, we've got water restrictions. You're allowed to use sprinklers 2 days a week. That won't be like that for much longer. Oh, in India they just turn the water off on you and the power. At random times. They just decide that there isn't enough for everyone and they just shut down half the water and half the power, from what I've been told, to various people. So you fill your bottles up with water after you've boiled it, of course, and you make sure you've got enough water to drink before they turn the water off on your bit. At least that's what I've been told. Okie dokie. Now, say for example, so whether we're talking about electricity, whether we're talking about water, whether we're talking about golden syrup, honey, coffee, whatever it is. It can be any sort of liquid or thing that flows through a medium, and so we talk about water and electricity and stuff like that. Interestingly enough, if you have pure water, electricity does not flow through pure water because pure water does not ionize. So anybody who says that electricity travels through water, if it's actually pure water, no, it won't. You actually have to have impurities in the water for the electricity to travel through. So how about that? Okay, now, say for example, we have... okay, so that's your OR gate. Now, the exclusive OR gate, and I'm not 100% sure how these are wired up. I think they're actually wired up with a transistor. Yes, they are wired up with a transistor. But I'm not actually going into how that works because that's a little bit complicated. But basically, an exclusive OR gate works if either one of the inputs is a 1, then the output is a 1. Okay? If either one or the other, so it's an exclusive OR, bit like your average marriage. You have a marriage and then you have an affair and you have one or the other. Okay? It's an exclusive thing. And I wouldn't condone that sort of behavior from anybody. Okay, so here we go. So exclusive OR. 0 XOR 0 is 0. 0 XOR 1 is 1. 1 XOR 0 is 0, is 1 even. Okay, 1 XOR 1 is 0. Can anybody give me a practical example of where you would use an XOR gate?
I have a light switch that was like that, actually.
Yes, two light switches, one at each end of the room. You walk into the room and you turn one of the switches to the state that it is not currently in, and the light comes on. You walk to the other end of the room and flick the other switch to the state that it is not in, and the light goes off. So if one of the switches is up and the other switch is down, then the light will be on. If both switches are up or both switches are down, the light will be off.
Can that be wired up without a transistor? Must be.
No, I think you've got to have some. I think you've got to have a transistor. You've got to have a logic circuit in there.
Maybe it's done in the switch because I used to have one at one of my other houses, and a friend of mine's got them anyway. So maybe it's in the switch.
Oh, look, there's somebody you could certainly ask about that, and I'm sure he'd be able to tell us.
Yes, and if he hasn't already had the switches off the wall to figure it out, he would have by now.
Oh, it's a pretty simple electrical concept, and people tend to go through it. Okay, so of course you're probably all asking me now at about 10:30, what does this have to do with subnetting? Why has he gone through Boolean arithmetic again? Well, because you need to use Boolean arithmetic for subnetting, okay? What happens is you have a network portion of an IP address, and you have a host portion of an IP address. Okay, so everybody who's drifted off to sleep in the Boolean operations, wakey wakey! This is where it gets hard. Now, the subnet mask is a 32-bit binary number with a number of ones on the left-hand side and a number of zeros on the right-hand side. And for a number to be a subnet mask, all of the ones must be on the left-hand side, and all of the zeros must be on the right-hand side. Okay? Everybody cool with that so far? Alrighty. Now, so say, for example, we have the subnet mask 255.255.255.0. Now, if anybody just puts in an IP address and then just hammers in 255.255.255.0 without even thinking about it, I will fail you. You have been warned. Okay, thank you. Just got that out of my system. 255.255.255.0. That is a Class C subnet mask, And as we revised in Module 5 quite a long time ago, those the default subnet masks for Class C networks are from the IP ranges 192 to 223. And we did go through those in the lecture, and I will go through those a bit later. What that says is that 3 bytes or 24 bits of the IP address, because we've got 255, which is 8 ones, so we've got 8 ones, 8 ones, 8 ones. That was very unpleasant with eSpeak, but that's okay. I think we've all got that now. 24 ones and 8 zeros. Okay, so the left-hand 3 bytes are your network portion, and the right-hand byte is the host portion. Okay, so if we take the address 192.168.1. Whatever that is. Okay, what we are saying is that the 192.168.1 is the network portion, host 64. Alright, so wherever we've got ones on the left-hand side of the subnet mask, that is the network portion. Wherever we've got zeros on the right-hand side, that is the host portion. Any questions so far? Alrighty, now I'm going to be a doozy. Let's say we have the address 169.254.23.45, netmask 255.255.0.0. Okie dokie, anybody tell me what sort of subnet mask 255.255.0.0 is? Class B. Yes, Class B. Okay. So Class A is 255.0.0.0. Class B is 255.255.0.0. Class C is 255.255.255.0. So they don't make it easy. They don't make it difficult. A, B, and C is one lot of 255, two lots of 255, and three lots of 255, followed by the necessary number of zeros. So, 169.254.23.45. How many bytes are in the network portion?
16.
I said how many bytes, but I'll take how many bits? 16 bits? How many bits? Yep, 2 bytes. And how many bytes are in the host portion?
Yep, 2.
Okie dokie. That's it, or 16 bits. So in other words, half of the IP address is network portion, and half the IP address is host portion. All right. Let's. Any questions on that so far?
No.
All righty. Now, if we... Now, there's no reason why a subnet mask has to be on a byte boundary. So say, for example, we have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.192. All right, people, how many ones do we have on the left-hand side? And I'll give you a few seconds to work that out. No, not 24. Yeah, okay. I'm gonna wait for another couple of answers. No. Okay, let me give you a bit of a hand here. 255.255.255.192. 255.255.255 is 8 plus 8 plus 8. Okay, everybody happy with that? So that gets us to 24. 192 is actually 128 plus 64, so that's another 2 on top of that. So we've got 8 plus 8 plus 8 plus 2 is 26 lots of 1s and 6 lots of 0. The only time you can have 32 bits in the subnet mask is if you've got a point-to-point address, and we don't talk about that at the moment. Okay. Now, the whole point of subnetting is figuring out how many networks we can have and how many hosts we can have. So let's go back to our Class C network, 192.168.1. something, with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. How many bits are in the network portion? Alrighty, how many bits are in the host portion? Okay, I still haven't seen an answer from Chantelle. Are you not sure how many bits are in the host portion? It's okay if you're not, because if you're not, I'll explain why. Okay, so there are 24 bits in the network portion, and there are 32 bits in an IP address. So 24 plus what is 32? Ah, good. I think the light bulb has gone on. Okay, cool. And that would be, yes it is. It's sinking slowly into the murk, but that's good. That's what we want. 24 and 8 is 32. Therefore, there are 24 bits in the network portion and 8 bits in the host portion. Okay. Now, there are two reserve... Okay, so, if there are 8 bits in the host portion, how many combinations, I should say, can we have on that network? No, I actually said how many combinations. I didn't say how many hosts.
256, huh?
256. 0 to 255. You all forget about 0, you non-programmer types. 0 is a valid combination. To 255 will give us 256 combinations. Okay. Now, there are two reserved addresses on every TCP/IP subnet. If all of the bits in the host portion are set to 0, that is the network address. It's the address of that network. So in our example, the address of the network would be 192.168.1.0. That refers to the whole network of the 192.168.1 network with a 255.255.255.0 subnet mask. Now, the CIDR, C-I-D-R, notation for that is 192.168.1.0/24. Alright, can anybody not see how that works? In other words, 192.168.1.0, and we have 24 bits in the network portion.
So what comes after the slash is just denoting the network portion.
Yes, because if you denote how many bits you've got in the network portion, you could subtract that number from 32 and find out how many bits are in the host portion.
Yep. Making sense. Yep, that's sweet.
Okie dokie. So, if all of the bits in the host portion are set to 0, that is the network address. So, I'm in the wrong typey field. 192.168.1.0.1.0. Yeah, no, that's okay. Okay, so that's the network portion. Now, the broadcast address is if all of the bits are set to 1. 192.168.1.255. That is the broadcast address of the 192.168.1 network. The network address refers to the whole network. The broadcast address lets you talk to every host on that network. Okay, you can broadcast something to every host on that network. Therefore, how many usable IP addresses do we have on the 192.168.1.0 network if two of the addresses are reserved? Excellent. Alrighty. Now, the fact is that this works no matter how many bits you've got in the network portion and how many bits you've got in the host portion. It just changes the proportion of numbers. So if we have 16 bits in the network portion and 16 bits in the host portion, then we have 65,534 hosts. 2 to the power of h minus 2 is the formula to give you the number of hosts you can have on the network. And H is the number of host bits. So if we say 2 to the power of 8 minus 2 is 254. So 2 to the power of the number of host bits minus 2 will tell you how many hosts you can have on that subnet, where H is the number of host bits or the bits set to 0 in the subnet mask. Any questions so far? Alrighty, now just to throw things into a tiz, if I have a network of 192.168.1.0 .1.0 netmask 255.255.195.192. Okay, so what we are saying here is that we have 26 bits of network and we have 6 bits of host. If we have 6 bits of host, how many hosts can we have on the network? 2 to the power of 6 minus 2.
That'd be 2 to the power of 6 minus 2.
Minus 2, yeah.
Yep, so that would be 62 hosts.
That is correct. All right, now here's a tricky one for you. What is the network address of that network? Remember, the network address is where all of the bits in the host portion are set to 0.
You're after the network address.
The network address is I'm in the wrong typey field. 192.168.
Yeah, okay.
See, this is where the wheels fall off the wagon. Okay. And we won't sing the song about the Cherokees the guy driving the wagon along being shot by the Cherokees, because that's probably not cool. So, if we have 192.168.1.0 and we set all of the host bits to 0, that is the network address of the 192.168.1.0/26 network. What is the broadcast address of that network? Can anybody work out what the broadcast address would be if we set all of the host bits to 1? And this is the thing that I think people are going to have to practice. And yes, we have 2 correct answers. Can anybody see how that works?
Yeah, thinking about that, I'd agree with those 2 answers.
That makes sense, yeah.
It's for the recording is 192.168.163.
That's right. Because we've only got 6 bits for the host portion, we can only have a range of 0 to 63. Now, obviously, because that's 6 bits, 2 to the power of 6 is 64, but we can only have from 0 to 63, and therefore 63 is the broadcast address, and 0 is the network address. Now, people get a bit thrown off when you tell them this, because they go, but it doesn't have a byte boundary. Why doesn't it just be 255.255.something.something? Well, they tried that, but we're running out of IP addresses. And if we subnetted on byte boundaries, we would only be able to allocate subnets of 256, subnets of 65,536, or subnets of 16.7 million. We need to be able to make smaller and larger subnets. So, for example, if we wanted to have, say, 1,000 hosts, we could either do it by having 4 Class C networks, or we can actually set the subnet mask to 255.255.252.0 would give us 1,024 or 1,022 hosts per subnet. So we need to be able to subnet on non-byte boundaries. And this is what we call classless inter-domain routing. And if you'd like to read about it, you can look up CIDR on Wikipedia. We don't go heavily into it, but it is important to understand that the subnet mask tells you how many bits are in the network portion and how many bits are in the host portion, and it doesn't matter if those numbers of bits are not a multiple of 8, the same, or a multiple of, a multiple of 8, the same rules apply. You just have to work it out. All right, so let's take one more example. If we have a subnet mask of 255.255.224, how many hosts are on that network? Or shall I say, how many bits have we got for the host? And I'll even help you by converting 224 into binary, because I'm a nice person.
How many bits have we got for the host?
64 and 32. That should be 224 converted to binary. 128, 64, and 32, so 111000. Now that I've given you that, how many bits are in the host portion? You're correct with /27, but how many bits are in the host portion?
5?
Yes. Anybody else having trouble with that?
A little bit, yeah.
All right. We have 255.255.255.224. We have to convert 224 into binary. The biggest power of 2 we can subtract from 224.
I've added an extra
0. Okay. Well, just to finish it off for the recording, the biggest power of 2 we can subtract from 224 is 128, so we put a 1 down. The next biggest power we can subtract is 64, we put a 1 down. The next biggest power we can subtract is 32, we put a 1 down. We're now down to 0, so we end up with 111000000. All right, so if we have 5 bits in the host portion, how many hosts can we have on that network? 2 to the power of 5 minus 2.
It's 30.
2 to the power of 5 minus 2.
Yeah, which is 32 minus 2.
That is correct. As Mr. Smithers, as Mr. Smithers says in Simpsons, excellent. Okay. I think we might be getting somewhere. What I'm going to try and do is I'm going to try and set you all a couple of exercises on this, and we're going to see how well people really understand this. This is important. This is a keystone of networking. If you can't do this, you shouldn't be working on TCP/IP networks. Go dig digits, break bricks, do something else. You really need to understand this to be working on TCP/IP networks. And the people who don't understand this have terrible trouble splitting up networks into subnets and actually planning and designing networks correctly. So, core knowledge, very important. And don't expect to get it straight away. You will need to do lots of practice, and you will need to, as we say, let the penny drop, and you will get it eventually. Or you can ask your significant other if they're into networking. They probably know how to subnet. But then again, they might not, and you might be able to give them a revision course on how to do it. People tend to forget this stuff if they don't use it too often. And not that I would necessarily recommend bailing people up and asking them if they know how to subnet, but it can be kind of fun, as long as you've got something to hide behind when they lob the newspaper at you. Yeah, no, that's okay. Anybody got any other questions? Because I think I'm just about done for today. I think everybody's probably had just about enough. Questions? Comments? Anything like that? Does anybody... Well, I don't suppose the word want is exactly what... Would anybody gain value from a few exercises on this to actually do some practice? Because I know making up your own examples is a bit tricky. Alrighty. So what we're going to do is I'm going to write up some exercises and you guys can work it out. And what I'm actually going to do is I'm going to write up the exercises and we're going to put them out there, and you're going to try and do as many of them as you can. And then if you can't do them, we're going to come back next week and we're going to talk about the questions that people had problems with, because I'm going to put all sorts of questions in this when I write it up later today. There's going to be scenarios. You're going to be subnetting business networks. You're going to be subnetting home networks. You're going to be slicing networks up. There's going to be all sorts of things in here. And it's okay. If you can't do them, we need to discuss with you guys what the problems are and what bits you're having trouble with as far as the procedure is concerned and that sort of thing. Any other... seems like I need another coffee. Any other comments, questions, queries on anything else in the Discovery course before I close this particular lecture down? I've got feedback from one of our local students that this was a good revision lecture, which is always nice to know. I hope some people got some nuggets of information out of here and became a little bit clearer with the process. We hope in a couple of weeks to have you guys a lot more clearer with this. Yes, it will be on QCAT later today, probably in about 30 minutes' time. And for those of you who don't know, that's www.qcat.org under Student Resources, Discovery 1, Audio, and you can download all of the lectures. And I would strongly recommend that before the exam, and this will be really boring, but you can do it while you're brushing the dog or something, download all of the lectures and stick them on your MP3 player, Daisy player, whatever, and play them through and at least have one listen through, because you might actually remember stuff. Or if you're having trouble sleeping before you're in exam, they're a good way to help yourself drift off. The exercise will be sent to Cavi Announce, so you'll have to wait until your email works again. I haven't written the exercise yet. But yes, we'll also try and make sure that the exercise does go up somewhere. However, if it does go up on Cavi Announce, it is by definition up on a website, so go check out the List Archives. And if you haven't been to the List Archives, and I'll key in the URL of the List Archives so that you can actually go and have a look, every message that has ever been posted to Cavi Announce or Cavi Discuss is on the List Archives. And they are at www.gots.net/mailmanarchives/cavi-announce. Did that work? I don't think it did. If you haven't been to the List Archives, I would strongly recommend that you take a visit to them. Also, the URL to the List Archives is at the bottom of each list post. It's also contained inside the headers of the list message. There'll be the link to the archives and stuff. And okay, hang on. Let me just triple check that. Yes, Srigath.
Yeah, like, can you just revise me what would be the public and private services for IP?
Next week.
Okay, fine, thank you.
I can tell you that there is three ranges of IP addresses which are private: 10.0.0/8, 172.16.0.0-172.31. .254/16, 192.168.x.0/24, and if you need to look those up, you should probably look up RFC 1918, list of assigned numbers, and they're all listed in there. Okay, so you can get to our page by going to www.qcat. Okay, go to that one, and there'll be a link to the archives. Hang on. So I've just given you slightly the incorrect archive URL. So it was pipermail/cavi-announce. So that was my screw-up there. I didn't actually put a virtual redirect in, but if you go to that list info page, you will actually see that there are archives. And for those of you who love text files, you can actually download monthly archives of the messages in a text file, if that sort of thing does it for you. Alrighty. I think that is probably about all we have for today. Unless there is any other questions on anything, and as I said, we will go over those public and private reserved IP ranges next week, but unless anybody has anything else to ask before we disappear, we hope you've enjoyed the lecture, and we will be available as usual on Skype. Well, I will be most of the day, except if I'm off eating things or drinking things, so there you go. Any final questions before we wind up?